I'm very excited to be able to introduce Fran, and I've never actually met Fran in the flesh. We have an email relationship, don't we, Fran? And mm-hmm. I'm not sure how many years ago it was, but Fran has always been incredibly supportive and generous in my sort of baby steps towards environmental storytelling, which I want to develop more and more. So Fran is not only a very respected and awarded storyteller with quite a prodigious output of recordings and books, but she's also a scientist. And she's a trained biologist, and she keeps it kind of quiet. You have to dig really hard on her website, but she actually has a PhD in botany. And as an aside, her husband is also a scientist. So I'd say there's a few scientific kind of conversations that happen at home. But Fran will be talking today about storytelling in the context of environmental issues. That's the particular thing that we've invited her to talk about, and that's what we'll focus on. But Fran actually has an incredibly diverse range of specialties in terms of storytelling. She's published books and taught workshops on Japanese folk tales. I think you speak Japanese, don't you, Fran? And translate. Sorry. And does stories with puppetry, has written books about that and taught about that, stories with music and storytelling for character education. And she's conducted workshops and residencies and performed not only nationwide but internationally. So as Earth Teller, also in her role as environmental storyteller, Fran has trained zoo docents and park rangers and environmental educators in the art of telling science in the shape of a story. And that was my first connection and admiration for the particularly unique thing that Fran brings to storytelling in the context of environmental storytelling. It's the way that she combines her scientific background with her passion for folk tales and, you know, something that can seem kind of opposite in some ways is the magic and the mystery and the non-factual nature of story folk tales with the factual nature of science. And what I loved is the way that Fran makes it an uplifting experience to hear those stories, and she'll explain more about that. But I especially loved how Fran developed something which I have since copied, which is to take a scientific fact and make that as a frame story, either before or after the folk tale, and then you're using the folk tale to illustrate a particular principle of environmental impact or of behaviour or of the wonder of nature. She kind of weaves the two things together, and then we know that people will be more motivated to take action in the world if they're not only aware of the facts from their head but also connected with their heart. That people will retain that information better, they'll be more motivated to change their behaviour also. So I don't want to rave on too much. There's so much more that I could say about Fran, but I want to give her more time to speak. So I heartily recommend that those of you who haven't yet encountered Fran's work, that you follow up by looking on her website and seeing all her recordings and books and workshops. And, I look forward to hearing everything
you have
to say, Fran.
Yeah, and Fran, before you start this wonderful talk, I noticed a lot of people got on. And so this is Allison reminding people that while Fran's talking, it usually works best for everybody if you hit *6 to mute the sound coming from your end. And Fran, feel free to remind people that if they get on after we've already made this announcement. But, you know, sometimes they have, like, cooking or the radio going on in the back. So I'm going to exit now. And I just want to also tell you, if for some reason you get lost on the call, just call back in. And that has it has to do with the difference between long-distance companies and freeconferencecall.com. I can't explain it all now, but don't give up. Just call us right back if you get lost on the call, and you should be able to get in using the same process. So I'm going to hit *6, and Fran, you can take it away.
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you, Jenny, for that very generous introduction, and welcome to the people who've been continuing to dial in. We welcome you. I'll be talking for a little while, and then we'll be open for questions and comments from people. Jenny mentioned the work that I've done in telling science like a story, or pairing a science tale with a folk tale. If you'd like to see some of those pairs, I've got a bunch of those on my website, because I contribute to a quarterly digital newsletter here in Oklahoma called The Environmentor. It's for people who teach environmental storytelling and park rangers and all. And in each column, I've paired a folktale with some scientific information about it, not always telling the factual information like a story, which is my goal, but at least pairing the two together. What I really wanted to talk about this time, though, was the concept of stealth storytelling, as described in the intro for or the description for this program. A lot of us are concerned about the environment, but we either don't feel we have the background to do what let's call green storytelling. That's nature-based, science-based stories about that information and those concepts. Or else, you know, we're already working with a repertory of Russian folk tales or family tales or something, and good grief, we want to do something, but does it mean we have to change our entire repertory? And Tony, I was going to mention you because I remember you telling me years ago you've even got degrees in environmental work, not environmental storytelling, but as trained as a naturalist, and can't find venues for it. I've had that problem too. Kevin Strauss, who's my co-director of the Eco-Telling Interest Group in NSN, we've had the problem that, well, maybe 10 years ago, schools wanted to hear environmental stories, but everybody's got their head in the sand now. And you can, of course, volunteer your life away for the Sierra Club and your local Audubon Society, and they'll be delighted to hear your stories, but they can't afford to pay you. And if you're working as a storyteller, that's not gonna cut it. So people like Brian Fox Ellis are doing good things impersonating Charles Darwin and, oh, I can't remember what all other important naturalists and scientists, and they do programs that way. That's the fantasy. And Doug Elliott, of course, with a possum on his shoulder, does wonderful naturalist stuff, but those are their particular niches. And what about the rest of us? And that's where stealth storytelling, stealth eco-telling comes in. And what I mean by that is telling a story that is not obviously green, not obviously associated with animals or plants or ecosystems or weather or the water cycle, a story that we may already know, a folktale we may already know, that we can see when we look at it, does communicate some of the important concepts that we need people to think about more carefully when they decide what to do with their lives, with their money, with their votes. Let me give you an example. You probably know a story about three wishes, or maybe even just one wish. Traditionally, people mess up with their wishes. There's the concept that Barry Commoner pointed out is there's no such thing as a free lunch. And when people are given the opportunity to have something that's too good to believe, it turns out that way. They mess up. Well, that's a human nature story. You know about the fisherman and his magic fish and the little old woman in the vinegar bottle who wanted her house to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and they always end up back where they started. It always falls through. And I think that's partly because our ancestors realized that there is no such thing as a free lunch. And it seems to me that that also is a very good analogy for things such as the technical wonders such as DDT, an insecticide that made the world much safer when we had malaria and other diseases carried by mosquitoes, when we had fleas and lice, buried typhus and other diseases. When you have DDT, that is wonderful. And, oh, and it was so safe, and it was going to be perfectly useful to dust yourself from head to toe. We did in my childhood, running in the dusting from the trucks. So safe you could eat a spoonful of it on television, as happened. Well, those wishes turn out not to be so true. Well, the four concepts that Barry Commoner invented, they're mentioned to help us kind of focus our thoughts. One was, no such thing as a free lunch. Another was, everything is connected, and everything goes somewhere, which is, of course, what happened with the DDT. It went into the food chain. And then Mother Nature knows best. In other words, things are more complicated than we would like to think. Well, any of the stories we already know that we enjoy telling about human nature, like, the poem about a kingdom lost because of a horseshoe nail, the unanticipated consequences of even a small thing, we should be alert to, because even wiping out one species might have consequences downstream that we haven't schooled ourselves to think about. So even if it's just a thing about a king and a horseshoe nail, or it wouldn't have to be about animals and plants, the unanticipated consequences of is it good luck, is it bad luck, the farmer and the horse that ran off. You don't necessarily know what you're getting when you make a decision. So much of human experience is like that. And, of course, that applies to our environmental consequences as well. So if we tell stories like that, we can be making some points for environmental thinking, even if it's not an obviously green story. Maybe another familiar example would be the story of King Midas, who knew what was good. Gold was good, and so more must be better. I think that's what my neighbors have in mind when they put too much plant food on their lawn and such things. Anyway, also, the idea that Buckminster Fuller pointed out, that pollution is good stuff in a bad place. And that's what happened to King Midas when his food and his bed, and in Hawthorne's version, his daughter, turned into gold when he got the golden touch. Unanticipated consequences, the difficulty of being able to judge, is something good or is it bad? It's not going to be just the one or the other. And our folktales, our myths, our legends that use those ideas can be gaining some environmental awareness for our listeners, even when the stories are not obviously green. Hodja stories, Nasruddin Hodja stories, can be very valuable. Do you know the one about he had lost his keys and was looking for them in a place where the light was good, even though he knew perfectly well that they had been lost somewhere in the backyard away from the light, different versions of that. I heard that story actually cited by someone who was reporting on the problem of the chemicals in fracking liquids, and the fact that you don't know what's in those liquids because the test hasn't been done. You have a little bit of information. That's where the light is brightest. But what you really need to know is what's hidden in the dark, which is where the keys really are. That's what Nasruddin Hodja and the Lost Keys can tell us. I've got lots more stories, but I'd really like to hear what people are thinking and what they want to ask about. So, Jenny, can we ask people to turn off their mutes and start asking me questions? And that way I'll yammer on about something relevant. If anybody's still there?
I'm here, Fran.
Hi. That sounds like Eric.
This is Papa Joe.
Oh, Papa Joe, hi.
Oh, I really don't have any questions for you. I'm just listening, though. I just wanted to let you know that there are people out here.
Okay.
And I'm listening too, and it might be that people need to be reminded that *6 unmutes them. And if they're like me, they're slow thinkers, so it takes me a while to think of a question. But I was really enjoying some of the examples that you mentioned I was familiar with that you discussed before, I've heard you talk about before. But the one of the Nazarene Hodja and the keys in the dark, I hadn't thought of using it in that way. And CSG is such a big issue here now because we're, you know, it's all, the tsunami is about to hit us. It's already started a bit here. And it was an enormous part of the local state election recently. It sort of shocked the country party enormously that people swapped from very conservative voting to green voting over CSG. And so it's really great to have some stories that I could use to help that cause. So thanks for that.
Wow, that's great. That's great.
Yeah.
When you have an opportunity, and Jenny, I know that you went out to the encampments when they were fighting against fuel on land.
It was not CSG, it was fracking. It was part of the Bentley campaign, and it was huge because they started off in our region in the most green and greeny sort of region, so it was an enormous. It was very close to the population centres, yeah.
Oh, my. Oh, my.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There are many stories about a small thing snowballing into a big thing, a story that you can use to tell about, to help people have kind of a model for thinking about what can ultimately be involved. They might say, oh, well, that's the problem over there, but it's not going to bother me over here. A word problem that actually was thrown at us by a high school math teacher, he told us about a man who had built a country mansion with beautiful gardens, and he had a lake, and his gardener came to him and said, boss, I found a new flowering water plant that will be so lovely in the lake, it will set off your swans, and it has no pests here, and it's very hardy, and it grows so well that it doubles in size every day. And the boss said, oh, wonderful, plant it. And they planted it at one side of the lake, and sure enough, every day it doubled. And at the end of 30 days, the lake was completely covered with this water plant. And the question that the math teacher asked was, on what day was the lake only half covered?
Only the day it was covered.
Pardon me?
Would it be the day before it was covered?
Right.
Yes, that's the point, because you know, when it's doubling at that rate, it's only half covered, and you think, well, hey, we still have the entire half lake.
Wow.
But here it comes barreling down. Of course, we very conscientious math students said, oh, but you didn't tell us how big the lake was, et cetera, et cetera. And he just chuckled and said, you don't need to know that.
Yeah.
That wasn't the point. But yes, you figured it out. Good.
And I'm not even good at math. I'm great relief.
Oh, logic.
Exactly. Oh, wow. But that's a really graphic. It really makes the connection between the head and the heart, I think, because you're in that imagining, you know, a beautiful lake, beautiful flowers, and then, you know, the leap, your mind then leaps out to extrapolating all the other things. And the thing that came up for me was, although I'm ambivalent about the whole population, we've got friends who are in the sort of anti-population growth kind of part, you know, groups, and I'm sort of slightly ambivalent about that. But you certainly, there's an impact of any increasing population, especially of a weed, but especially of humans as well. And you can see how geometrically things can expand all sorts of different things.
Yes. I did a whole column for the environmenter on small changes with big results, or the fact that we are not too good at predicting. Someone said it's hard to predict, especially the future. And I heard this. It could just as well have been a cartoon about a man who jumped off the top of a 20-story building and was heard to say, as he passed the third floor, "So far, so good."
Yes. Yes. It's a sad but poignant reflection on our time.
And I'm afraid I live in the state that has the senator who brought a snowball into Congress to prove that there was no global warming. So far, so good for him.
I know. Anybody else want to provide a question or a comment?
Yes, this is Tony. Fran, do you have stories about people we can do little things in stories that actually help with things? So if I can't move the world, what can I do to try to just do the little bit in my corner of the world?
Oh, there are some wonderful real stories about people doing that with reforestation and so forth. But the stone soup, Neil Broth, each person contributed just a little, and together they ended up with a great big pot of soup for everybody.
And you've also done profiles on heroes, haven't you? Green heroes.
Yes, that's one of my subjects for this summer's summer library programs. The story about the real tree huggers, the women who put themselves, it took about six of them to get around some of the big old trees that they were defending in India. If you look up tree huggers.
Yes.
And when you want to encourage people to take action, the small actions like recycling water bottles or not even buying bottled water in the first place, or recycling any other materials, or refraining from buying excess packaging and so forth, people look at that and they say, that is such a drop in the bucket. How can it possibly add up? But there are traditional stories about the ants who come along and carry away one grain of sand and ultimately remove the whole boulder. There is a man in, I forget if it was China or India, who did literally by himself not move a mountain, but he cut a path so that you didn't have to take 40-mile detour.
I remember that story.
Yeah. So there are people who individually really are devoting themselves to making a big difference.
It is a really important point, isn't it? I agree, Tony. It's that for all of us. Like, well, for me personally, I draw strength from those kind of stories too, because it is so easy to get overwhelmed by the news and just sort of think, oh, what's the point? You know, you have those moments.
So, Fran?
Yes.
To answer Tony's question, I actually have a couple of folk tales that might qualify for that. There's a Swedish folk tale. I believe it's called Fault on the Swallow's Tail. It's about a little boy who wants to make wishes, and he just wishes and wishes all the time, but nothing, of course, happens. And he sets out because he hears that if he puts salt on the swallow's tail, he can make wishes, and the wishes come true. And the swallow wants something before it allows him to put the salt on his tail, and he ends up getting all of his wishes to come true because he earns them. But it starts out small and gets bigger and bigger and bigger till he has everything that he ever wanted in before he gets the chance to do that tale. And I have a version called For a Wish that...
Called what?
for a wish.
For a wish.
Correct.
Yeah.
That works really good. Another story that I've been telling is, I believe it's a Tibetan tale called Kingdom of the Mice, and it talks about how the mice are doing a bunch of work for the human king, and he's pretty impressed by how little people can do so great of deeds. So those were the two things I wanted to offer toward that.
And do you remember the Aesop fable about the lion who spared a mouse's life and then the mouse was able to cut the lion?
I'm just thinking about that, yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome story.
Yeah, because even a small thing can sometimes make a very positive difference. The Barry Commoner's point about, he calls it nature knows best, but basically, the first rule of tinkering is to save all the parts, is the way Aldo Leopold put it, because even the small creatures, well, for instance, how about the pollinators, the honeybees, little old honeybees, how much of our diet would be lost if we didn't have them for pollinating? And they say in some places that the wild native bees are even more effective as pollinators than the imported European honeybees are. And yet we wipe out their habitat by farming from road to row and wiping out the hedgerows and the native plants in which they live.
But if we were to cultivate the wild bees, we might be able to sort out some of the problems.
Yes, and in fact, permaculture folks make little homes for wood bees out of tubes, paper tubes that the wood bees like to live in, and they keep kind of trash piles and things like that. The community beautification committee would not approve, but you do that in your backyard so that the bees have a place that they can build their underground homes. Many of them live underground rather than in a hive.
What you mean, leaf litter or
branches. Branches and trunks and things like that. Some of the stories that we know that are about the whole picture versus the parts, of course, you know the one about the blind man and the elephant.
Mm-hmm.
And different people may focus on just one part of the problem, and they say, well, but what about poverty, and what about racial justice, and what about it? But it's all connected. It's all part of the way we're dealing with the world. And then you know the noodle head stories where the people get confused because they count, but they don't count themselves. Are you familiar with those?
Oh, can you tell more about that one? I know I sort of know it, but not clearly enough to recall
the
details.
Well, there are several different. I think it's a worldwide idea. There's one from the Middle East about a man who was taking, let's say, 6 donkeys that he had raised, and he wanted to take them into town. And, of course, it made sense to ride one. So as he went riding along, you know, and then he could count
that's
on
like
five.
The Aesop one,
right?
With the donkey, the father and the son. Yeah.
No, it's not about one donkey and a father and a son. It's about counting a group of donkeys and forgetting to count the one that you're riding on. So when he got off the donkey, rounded all 6 of them up and counted. He counted 6. But then when he was riding one and counted the donkeys with him, he counted only 5. And he became very, very worried. And when he finally got to town, he explained his problem to a village person who said, well, I think there are 7 donkeys here, including the noodle head, you see.
Right.
But,
you're right. Sorry. I didn't get it.
But there are stories about fishermen who weathered a storm and were afraid that someone had been washed overboard because when they counted, they only counted their companions and not themselves. And that kind of story seems to be universal. Hiroko Fujita does one with little kitten beanbags or with origami animals where they've been left to look after each other and they try to do it by counting and forget to count themselves. Kindergarten kids think that's hysterical because they've just learned how to count and they get, oh, I forgot to count himself. So it's a kind of universal idea. But basically, if you think about it, it means that unless you include what you are contributing, you are not seeing the whole picture. You're not seeing your part in the whole thing.
Yes. Yes.
I would like to, this is Audrey, I'd like to ask her a question. I mean, these stories are illustrating the points that you're saying that they illustrate. I agree with that. But I don't know how you're using them. I mean, are you just telling the stories, or then are you talking about them with the kids or the audience afterwards to bring out the ideas that you're, you know, that you're trying to get across? That's what I'm a little confused about.
Okay. Yeah. If I have an opportunity to talk with people, of course I bring out the point. But the reason I call this stealth eco-telling is that very often we don't get an opportunity to be blatantly and honestly environmental. There are so few venues that will freely advertise us. I don't know, maybe somewhere it's better, but in Red, Oklahoma, an environmentalist is equivalent to a communist terrorist. And so I still want to get people accustomed to thinking along these lines of complexity and connection and involvement, because there seems, at least some people I run into, there seems to be such a temptation to think, well, if things are bad, if we just get rid of them, everything will be fine. And if things are good, then we want that. And we'll just get more of that, and everything will be fine. And if we just do one thing, we'll be fine. And people just don't seem to have a handle on grasping the complexity, the fact that something that's good can be good in a certain amount and bad in another amount. You got a drought, you got a flood, both water.
Okay, so you, I mean, because I did a program and told those kind of stories. It was for the kids, and we just told the stories, and that was it. You know, and I have no idea how it stayed in their heads or what happened, so I should just hope that it did, is what you're saying.
Yeah, because, I mean, if we're not being hired to, as my mother-in-law used to say, pound it into the ground and break it off.
Mm.
If we're not being hired to make the point, I think we can still feel we're doing something if we provide people with a model of thinking, with a pattern that they can fit things into and say, well, wait a minute, you know, maybe it's like stone soup, and maybe if we all contribute a little something, we'll all end up better.
Mm. Mm.
Okay. So are you looking for a whole program with those kind of stories without telling people that you're doing that, or just putting one or two in a program about, you know, so that maybe it's a springtime program or a whatever theme program or whatever you want program?
Well, I try to sneak in as many as I can.
Okay, thank you.
You know, if you've been hired to tell Revolutionary War history, it's kind of hard to slip in something like that, but you might be able to.
Mm-hmm.
Unanticipated consequences happen all the time. And stories that, you know, I've made up a list for the workshops that I do on this. trying to find stories that probably everybody knows. It's difficult in the States anymore because so many people tell personal experience stories. We have nothing in common in our repertories, but we often recognize Three Pigs, Three Billy Goats Gruff, you know, that kind of thing. We recognize the Tailor's Coat and Sody Saleratus and stories like that, so that I've got lists of stories that more or less everybody maybe knows so that we can talk about them. But it's really hard to do a workshop if everybody's got their own unique repertory and they're guarding it with their professional lives, and we can't really talk about it. Cumulative tales of things getting bigger and bigger and worse. You know about the Golden Goose story where everybody got attached on in a long chain?
No, I don't know that Golden Goose story.
Oh, well, there's one version where Jack or somebody got a hold of a Golden Goose, and anybody who tried to take it away from him stuck on to him and the goose. And then the next person stuck on to that person, and it ends with a crazy parade of people going down the street, and the rich man's daughter, who hasn't been speaking or making a sound, sees the accumulation of crazy people and laughs out loud, and sure enough, Jack gets to marry her. Happy ever after.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. But that's a story in which one thing connects to the next, to the next, to the next, and things get bigger and bigger and more complicated.
Okay, so as an example of how complicated nature can be and how interconnected.
Well, of how something that starts small and seems harmless can get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
And then stories about how it might take many small contributions to accomplish something. You know about the I think it's Tolstoy, pulling up the turnip, where the turnip was so big that the whole household, you do this as an audience participation story with kiddos, and all these people are pulling and pulling, but it wouldn't come up until finally the mouse or the bumblebee or somebody added that last little. So,
yeah, which relates to, was it Tony's question about that, about things to encourage people to feel okay about, you know, that I've got a contribution to make no matter how small I feel?
Well, I'm not sure I heard you clearly, but I think he was asking for stories about people who could only do a small thing and were feeling that it wasn't adding up to very much. And and of course the problem is that of course one person can't magically turn the tide on everything, but a whole lot of people together can make a difference.
Yeah. Which I think is also, it's a cultural difference that we need to shift from individualistic, because we live in a very individualistic culture where we think that, you know, there's going to be a hero or an expert or something, and we're actually got to move back to that sense of community, that as a community we can do things together.
Yeah. And the contributions that people make, I know I've told Stone Soup at well, it was a meeting of women who had worked for a couple years to create a shelter for victims of domestic violence. And we had to write bylaws and get grants and all kinds of stuff. And some people just sewed the curtains, you know. But when we finally got it together, I told the story about Stone. Because each person contributed just a carrot or just an onion, but we ended up with enough soup to feed all these people who needed it.
Mm.
And that's a cooperation story.
Mm. Mm. Which is huge, because often when all that work falls to people, they get so burnt out, and it can just help a little bit of extra help to make the difference.
Yeah.
Mm.
And there are Märchen, long folk tales, that are fun to tell to older kids and to adults about someone who's on a quest and gets helpers, and the helpers are really weird, and you wonder what they could possibly contribute, but it turns
like
out...
Hardy Hardhead. That is,
hello?
Like Hardy Hardhead?
That could be one. I don't know that one. Fool of the World and the Flying Ship is one that Mary Hamilton tells.
Yeah, that's it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And people who may feel that they're kind of oddballs and don't know what they could possibly do may be just exactly what's needed at the right minute when you need a bunch of people working together.
Another one is the Anansi tale about Anansi and his six children.
Uh-huh.
They all have really, really weird, people know it, but anyone who doesn't know it, like one of them is so large and round and soft, they can't imagine her ever do anything constructive, but she's so soft and large as a bed that when Anansi gets stolen by a bird, she lies down and he can land softly on her, and her brothers and sisters can bounce on her and be happy and laugh. And each one of them has a really bizarre kind of a skill, but together they save their father and there's a happy ending.
That's wonderful. And
yeah.
And there is an Anansi version of it also, the Cowtail Switch story.
Uh-huh.
About the father being brought back to life from the bones, and the different sons had done a different part in finding the bones, arranging the bones, putting flesh and blood and breathing life back into it. And it often is offered as a dilemma tale, who did the most important part in bringing him back, and the traditional ending was that it was the youngest child who asked, whatever happened to our father, who instigated all the rest of it. But an important thing there is that none of them could have done it alone.
Yeah. Yeah, so same ending with the other one, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that's how it works with our attempts to try to stand up to Monsanto and the Koch brothers and the International Bank and all these other, et cetera,
It strikes me that is the nature of stories for our time, is actually about shifting from the idea of the cult of the hero and the heroine to our community collective work, because all of the tasks are kind of daunting unless you believe that together you can all make a difference.
And that would be bringing me to another hobby horse. That would bring me to the fact that that gives a positive spin on what people can hope to do, because I've been dismayed that very often what is offered as environmental storytelling is about how we're all going to hell in a handbasket and it's all falling apart and the species are going extinct and the environment's getting polluted, and you kids that I'm telling a story to, you may as well just give up right now because the future is going to be horrible. Well, that is not motivating.
No.
Stop it, Fran. I've taken my belt off. I'm going to hang myself now.
I bet, yeah, or at least go get a six-pack and kick back, so much of what has been offered as environmental storytelling is about the tragedy of the commons, or how we're all despoiling our future. And at least for the last story in your set, you need to tell some of these stories about cooperation and about the contributions that individuals can make that can make a difference.
I think there's a book in that, Fran.
I have to
book. This is Tony thinking about Stone Soup and just realizing that if I've got one potato,
I mean, I can eat the potato and it's going to keep me alive, but what I contribute and what everybody else contributes makes it so much better in the end to put it together and share.
Right, right. Because that story is often set in a community where people are so worried about hardship and famine that they're hoarding what they've got and not contributing it, not sharing it together. And the thing that the traveler did was to show them that they don't have to give everything all at once. They can just give something and it will make a difference and it will make everything better. Well, do you know the story about Nasruddin and the traveler? Nasruddin Hoxha?
Which one?
He was sleeping on his front porch and a traveler came by and said, excuse me, I'm a stranger here. I'm on my way to the next town. How long will it take me to get there? And Nasruddin opened one eye and looked at him and then went back to sleep. And the traveler asked again, and Nasruddin just stared at him. And finally, the traveler said, well, okay, you're going to be rude. And he went storming off in his direction. And Nasruddin watched him for a few seconds and then hollered after him, 15 minutes! And the traveler stopped and came back and said, look, that wasn't hard. Why didn't you tell me when I asked in the first place? And Nasruddin said, I didn't know how long it would take until I saw how fast you could walk.
I love that.
and that, you know, if you don't start walking, you're not going to get it. So I've used that story in a number of situations. Mm.
And that reminds me of a different story, Fran.
Good.
Of the traveler who comes down the road and finds a farmer working in his field, and he asks how the people are in the next town coming up, whether they'd be friendly.
Uh-huh.
Or,
uh-huh.
And the farmer says, well, how did you find the people in the last town? And the traveler says, oh, they weren't very nice at all. That's why I'm asking. Farmer says, I think you'll find the people just about the same in this next town. A little later, another person comes down the road asking the farmer the same question, how are the people in the next village? And the farmer says, well, how did you find those people in the last one? He said, oh, they were very friendly and nice. And the farmer said, I think you'll find them the same.
That's a wonderful story. Now, can we find a stealth eco-telling angle in that? I keep hearing dings. I don't know whether people are leaving us or joining us.
Well, I joined you. I'm Gail.
I'm Anita.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, and I'm Aunt Leanne. I joined a little while ago, but I've been listening.
Yeah, we've been
good.
Listening.
Nice. They've been lurking, good. Well, I think that story about you kind of take with you the expectations of how you're going to find things could apply to, if you're about to go and lobby your state senator, which I have done on the subject of the XL pipeline and so forth. And you could go there with the idea that, you idiot, you have no idea what you're doing, and I've come to tell you what you ought to do. And sure enough, is an idiot. But aside from that, if you go and show him that you are a reasonable person and you live in his district and he is your representative and he should be representing you too, as well as the fossil fuel companies that run your town, then maybe you can have a different kind of experience.
Can I just throw in that what comes to me there is that personally, I'm incredibly tribal, I recognize that I tend to gravitate towards people who are green and left, who have all the same values as me, and I find it incredibly difficult to tolerate differences of opinion. And when I went to the Bentley campaign, which was anti-fracking, and we successfully defended that, and the company's gone away for now anyway, what was really amazing about that experience was that the group was extremely attentive to being inclusive and open-hearted towards people of all different political backgrounds. So we had people who were who had voted conservative all their lives and who, you know, thought of Greenies as, you know, feral, you know, crazy loons, and they were working alongside people who'd been environmental campaigners for many decades, and everyone came together in a spirit of respect. And that was constantly cultivated all the time, you know, just remember that. Don't make big generalizations about National Party people, because you may be standing next to a lifetime member of the National Party, and, you know, that's not going to help. And we had, you know, country people who said, you know, it was some of the happiest days of their lives. They had more hugs than they'd ever had in their life. And it was just such a great time, because we did manage to get outside our own tribe and have a bit of a broader approach to things. And it was that was the success of the campaign, was because it was very broad. It had a huge multitude of people, and then maybe, you know, people took a bit more notice of us. As usual, the media started sidelining us as a bunch of dirty hippies, and that was constantly refuted by more and more reports of all these people who were lawyers and, you know, the normal story. But we were also, there were National Party voters and country people and farmers and the broad church, and so it had actually a big implication that people were able to work in harmony with each other.
That's wonderful. That's a perfect match to the story about the farmer and the two travelers coming by.
Yeah.
But do you see how this works? You take a traditional story, or you might be able to do it with a personal story, and look at it and try to look under the surface. It doesn't have to be a story that's about plants and animals and charismatic megafauna. It doesn't have to be a story about pollution and recycling and so forth. And you can look into some of these stories that are just fun to tell, because they're about experience that we and our ancestors have been having for thousands of years with what happens when you do X, Y, and Z. And I can't guarantee that any one of these stories is going to shift someone's position on fossil fuels or whatever, but it will give them a model for thinking about things that's a little bit more complex and connected than our, at least in America, our usual way of good guys and bad guys and black hats and white hats and so forth.
So, Fran, I have, Ms. Papa Joe, one more story that I wanted to put out there for folks that are looking for some folk tales. And The Gifts of Wally Dad, for a story about living simply and the rewards thereof.
That's a nice one.
Can you clarify that for me in Australia and maybe other people over there who don't quite get that? What can you tell more?
Well, living simply, the character, this is a Middle Eastern story, and I believe you could find it just by typing in The Gifts of Wally Dad into the internet.
D-A-D?
How do you spell Wally Dad or whatever you just said?
Wally, W-A-L-I, Dad, D-A-D.
D-A-D, okay.
Another story that I might recommend, we're all familiar with the tailor's coat story about wearing something down and, you know, reuse, recycle, etc. But there is a story that I have put together. It was first mentioned on the internet on Storytel listserv about Ananda. Ananda was one of the early followers of Buddha. And I've written up a version of it that's on my EcoTeller tales. That was recently. That may not be on the website yet. But basically, he was unusual in that he preached to women as well as to men. And he lived a very, very simple lifestyle. And the queen of some principality invited him to preach to her and her women. And they were so gratified by his message of peace and compassion and all that the queen gave him a bag of gold. The king was very much disturbed by this monk coming and preaching this stuff to his women folk, and he decided he would destroy the reputation of the monk. In front of everyone, he said, oh, so you have a vow of poverty, but you accepted the gift of the bag of gold. And how does that reconcile with your poverty? And Ananda said, well, I will use it to buy clothing. The king said, oh, really? You could get 500 outfits and more with that. What are you going to do with all that? Oh, it's not for me. It's for the poor people in your village because they need clothes. And so the king, all along he's trying to stump him, said, well, you say that things should not be wasted. Don't they have clothing already? Well, yes, but the clothes are all worn out, and so they'll wear the new ones. Oh, what's going to happen to the worn-out clothes? And from there it goes through a whole cycle where the worn-out clothes are, oh, I forget all the details, made into quilts. And the old quilts are made into rugs, and the old rugs are made into rags, and doormats, and down and down and down until nothing left but fibers. And the king said, well, what's the use of that? And Ananda said, well, they will mix that with mud and plaster it on the walls to mend the cracks in their houses. And the king was so shamed by how scrupulously every little scrap would be used and reused and reused by the poor people, that he gave, I think he gave Ananda another bag of gold. I don't even remember.
That's great.
That's an awesome
story.
Well,
Fran, you've given us some bags of gold in your stories tonight.
Yeah, I really like that one.
Yeah, you have.
I love that one.
I hope that's one that you can use. You know, that if there is historical basis to it, and I, you know, when I was writing it up for the Environmenter, I tried to find out who Ananda was. There was an Ananda who was a monk, but the stories, how many thousand years ago was that?
Wow!
And you say that it was on the Storytel listserv, Fran?
Well, someone.
It was. It was. I actually tell that story, Fran.
Oh, good, good. Excellent. Okay,
how
so
do
you
we
probably
find it?
Remember the details better than...
Sure,
I
do. If you'd like, I can go through it fairly quickly.
Yes.
Okay, it's all right
please.
With us.
And also how to find it.
So you had it correct as far as the he's buying the clothes for the villagers, and the villagers, what are you going to do with the clothes? He says... They'll make them, they'll sew them together to make quilts. Well, what's to happen to the old quilts? Well, they're kind of worn out, so perhaps we'll use them to stuff the pillows.
Pillows,
well, what about the old pillows? Well, those are worn flat, but we could weave them together to make rugs. So what do you do with the old rugs? Well, they're so worn that if we're lucky, we can fold them together to make doormats. So what happens to the old doormats? Well, they're so worn out, they're just rags. And so you're going to throw away the rags? No, we'll mix them with mud to fill the holes in the walls.
Very good.
Oh, okay.
Good, thank you. That's the sequence.
And I also give out the second bag of gold, but that's not part of the story as I heard it originally. It just makes the king buy into that whole process, and I love that.
Yes. Yes. Very good. And that's and this is Tony who's talking?
No, Papa Joe.
Papa Joe, again.
Thank you.
Tony's much louder.
Oh, well, you can.
Do you guys know where you would find it? A couple of us wondering where you would actually find the whole. Is it on a recording of yours, Fran, or?
Well,
no,
I did.
It's on Echo Teller's website. Is that where it is?
Well, it's one of the stories that I contributed to the Environmentor newsletter.
Okay, so we can look there.
That's published digitally by University of Central Oklahoma, something like that. At any rate, on my website, there are some of the older columns, and it's Tales from the EcoTeller or something like that. I forget what the link is called on my website. But it does tell how to contact the Environmentor, and the more recent editions, you'd end up downloading a 20-page newsletter. I'm working with my webmaster, who happens to be our son in Kansas, to try to excerpt just the pages with my stories in order to update the more recent stories. But I did put.
You should make it into a book.
Well, I've thought about that. Can you recommend a publisher that I can count on? Ted Parker's.
I'll talk to you more about that afterwards. Can I also throw in, before we do a big thank you and a wrap-up, it's hard to stop because it's so fascinating, but when you were talking about how everything's interrelated, I just wanted to quickly throw in that last year I came across the Environmental Sustainability Compass, which is a really great reference point for speeches and writings and stuff that people have synthesized how interconnected things are, how the environment impacts on people's, you know, health and economics and so on. It's a really great resource.
And you have that on our webpage, don't you? On the webpage that you and Fran sponsor? I thought that you were going to post it.
Right.
If not, let's do.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, great. Okay.
Well, I want to be sure before we wrap up entirely to emphasize how important I think it is to tell stories that offer a model for something positive that people can do. You probably know the story about wine for the feast.
Yes.
Or palm wine, where everyone was supposed to bring wine and contribute it to a vat so that they could toast their chief. And everybody ended up bringing only water, so they had nothing but water. And that is a story that indicates it's about what you contribute, but in this case, it's a downer. It's a negative story that says if you contribute less than your best, you're going to get not much out of it. It's a cautionary tale. And I've taught it to school teachers who use it as a cautionary tale about the quality of work that they expect. But that doesn't get you anywhere. Whereas, you know, the story about heaven and hell and they're identical, the laden tables, but the people can't eat because the utensils are too long and they can't get them into their mouths. But they feed each other across the table. That's a story about cooperation. And even if it doesn't directly benefit you, you can benefit someone else, and they, we hope, will work with you, and we'll all be the better for it. So I think that's a better way to do it.
Good.
That's wonderful. Mm. Thank you so much, Fran.
Okay.
May I ask a question before we go?
Please.
This is being recorded, I understand.
Yes, it's okay.
And I missed the beginning because of the UConn game. How do we hear the beginning?
If you go to the Healing Story Alliance website.
Okay.
And I'm on that page right now, so let me scroll up. And you'll see at the top of the menu, and that would be healingstory.org is how you get there. And then you choose events, and the drop-down list, you'll see past teleconference recordings.
Oh,
and it'll probably take up to 2 weeks for this recording to get on the website. I try to remember to announce it on the Healing Story Alliance listserv, but I don't always remember. So feel free to ask if it hasn't shown up in 2 weeks and you're wanting to hear that part, because we're really glad that we captured it this time. We were having trouble last time, so we had to have Fran back because this is too valuable to not have for posterity. And briefly, I just wanted to mention also that on Tuesday, May 5th, we had to change some dates around. So Elisa won't be talking until next fall. But on Tuesday, May 5th, instead of the later date she had originally chosen, Mary Louise Chown will be talking about stories at the end of life and her experience telling stories to patients and families and folks at the end of life. And then on Tuesday, June 9th, we're going to have Abigail Fisher-Lang talk about being a storyteller and a celebrant. And so she facilitates different passages in life ceremonies and incorporates storytelling into that. And both of those two folks are Canadian storytellers, so it'll be fun to have them talk. And then we will break for the summer and resume in the fall with Elisa in September and Lorna Zarnota in October. So we'll post all those on the Storytell listserv as well as healingstory.org for everybody.
Oh, good, good.
Wonderful.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, Fran. And Jane.
And if you think of questions afterwards, you know, you can just contact me, Fran, at franstallings.com or earthteller@ionet.net. And
can I also suggest, Fran, that we do that via the Healing Story Alliance? Can we? Because I think you're at least...
That's a great idea. And then we can continue the conversation with folks.
Yeah, because even if you're not a financial member of Healing Story Alliance, you can still sign up for the emails, which Alison may be able to explain better than me. But in that way, we can all talk together about because we may all have all desperate to ask you more questions, and we can all listen, and you don't have to reply to everyone individually.
Yeah, and people can just go to the membership drop-down on that same healingstory.org and look where it says about the HSA listserv, and that's free for everybody. I mean, we love donations and we love members, but we're like trying to stay like PBS and put the information out there for everybody.
Yay. So with that, I'd like to wrap it up and say what a great honor and privilege it was for me to be able to introduce you, and I feel really inspired. Actually, I've got all these great things going on in my life, but just at the moment I was feeling quite flat and lacking motivation, and so you've completely fired me up, Fran, and thanks so much to everybody who contributed great ideas and stories. Thanks to Papa Joe and Tony and everyone who, and Kevin and everyone who offered great ideas and comments and stories, and thank you so much for what you do in the world, Fran. You're a constant inspiration to me, and thanks for coming back again when we couldn't get the recording happening the last time, because that was a great session too, but it's great to have this one actually recorded for everybody to listen to.
Lovely. Thank you so much for having me come back, and thanks to everybody who dialed into this. I think we had a larger attendance than we did last time, and it was wonderful to have all the contributions.